Well, good evening. As usual, it is so good to get back. It just feels wonderful. So nice to chant our words. I feel like those are our words for the sutra. Other people have other ways of chanting it, but we have our original ones. The other ones are nice, actually. They say, instead of saying Shariputra, they say, O Shariputra, which adds a little of emotion to it that otherwise it doesn't have. O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. You can see him there, or whatever it is. All five skandhas are empty, no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness. There's always a debate about what word to use for that concept. And of course, San Francisco Zen Center has a totally different translation now. It's not even close to what we're used to. It's all words pointing somewhere. So I heard from Cornelia, and she said you all didn't get anywhere, you didn't get past emptiness, is what she said. Well, she thought she was going a little bit farther, but so I'm assuming that you all have thoroughly studied and understood emptiness now and have got a full grasp of the essence of the Heart Sutra. Was it helpful? Good, good. Well, I have a handout tonight that has some things that Koban said about emptiness that I thought you might enjoy. So I don't know whether Cornelia talked about all dharmas last week, what these dharmas are that are marked with emptiness and what that means. It goes back to an old Buddhist, early Buddhist idea that that called things dharmas. Little d dharma is each thing is a dharma. There was an idea that almost all dharmas were the same as emptiness, but there were a few that were marked to make them permanent. So I don't even know what the permanent ones were, but there were a few that were permanent and everything else was marked with emptiness. And the Mahayana thinking came along and said, well, wait a minute, how does that work? How could it possibly be that emptiness is emptiness and there isn't anything that doesn't turn into something else? There's nothing that's permanent. If you sit down and try to figure, you can't find anything. It's all bits and pieces that are coming together and falling apart in different ways. So That's where this came from. All dharmas are marked with emptiness, not just some of them, but all of them. And appearing and disappearing, tainted and pure, all of those are judgmental ideas about the dharmas, and there were some that were perfect and pure and others that were polluted. And in the Mahayana view, if you step back, you have to see that those are just comparisons that are being made about something that can't be measured. Ultimately, you can't measure things. We say up, and that creates down. We say pure, and that includes impure, you could say. So when we start tricking our mind, you know, using words, especially of judgment, we begin to believe that there's such a thing. And what this is saying is, no, it's too big for that. Everything is included. So, increasing and decreasing, Coben says in here, a sesame seed and the universe have the same weight. Ultimately. Of course, in the relational way of our everyday, that's an absurd statement. But it's a very refreshing statement to realize that we don't have to be so weighted down by the judgments of how things are big or small or with us or not with us or any of the things that we desire. Coben says, if you think you're originally a sinner, there will never be an opportunity to be saved because sin can never become an element together with salvation. It becomes separated, opposites. This means the real world seems beyond you, while in truth the real world is always with you. And that's the basic message of the Whole Heart Sutra, that whatever happens, it's all right here, and it's all okay. It's always with us. It never goes away. So this business about no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, and so forth, is all about how we as sensory instruments, almost, that we are not discrete objects ourselves, that what we know and how we know it is through our senses. So without our eyes, this room disappears. We take in through our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, the world. So we can't say the world's out there and I'm here, in here. The world is in here. This is the world. And each one of us is a world. And each one of us has a different point of view, a different perspective. So although Wendy's looking at the beautiful persimmons and I'm looking at them, it's really different. because her conditioning and position is so different from mine. And we don't even know if we're seeing the same thing. We assume so. When we were kids, we used to say, no, when I say red, is that the same red as your red? And then we'd have to say, I don't know. I think so. I think I know. Dan?
This is a perennial question, because in some religions, they assert a non-destructible, well, not destructible, an external absolute reality.
Yes.
And this sounds, in an absolute sense, they're denying that. Because if it's with each one of us, then when I disappear,
your world disappears.
My world disappears.
Yep.
And yet, the practicality says that the apples are there in front of us. Right? I mean, later, presumably, we'll eat one, and you can't really deny that you're eating one or I'm eating one. And yet I know I'm colorblind, and I'm quite sure that I see those colors and those exact two colors very differently from you. And yet, do they have their own world? And when they disappear, then that reality is gone.
Yes.
So maybe in that sense, it really, you know, their that world is participating in each of our world until that world disappears.
Exactly, and we do that with each other too.
So it's like this is the Buddhist idea of the arising and the falling.
Yes.
Right? So, but we get wrapped up wanting to say, maybe not in the case of the fruit, but in the mountain case or the universe case, it's going to exist.
Mm-hmm.
But that too is false.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it'll take kalpas, but it too will.
Yes.
Fall away.
And there are many other universes, so who knows what happens to universes. You know, that part of it, we really don't know. We're new to this.
So the real fallacy comes in our own world is when we try to take things that are even much shorter lived than universes and try to make them permanent.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
I'll always love you. Or I'll always have you.
Yes.
Job, right?
Yes.
You know those things are not so permanent.
No, alas, it's a sorrow for us. It makes life so poignant. We feel so attached to what's so good about our life. We love it so much, and we would like it to stay the same, and it just won't. It just, no matter how hard we try, and sometimes we try really hard. Wendy? Yes. Yes, it is. It's a great relief. Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is.
And we do thrive on shame. We like variation and stimulation and excitement.
It's true. It's true. We do until we have something that's really, really yummy. And we want to keep it.
But we wouldn't like it.
No, we wouldn't, would we?
That's why depictions of heaven are always so boring.
Well, scary, actually. Think how we would... In the Buddhist heaven, you do get bored and get reborn somewhere else eventually. It's not a place to stay. It's too good. Everything is fine there, and nothing happens. It's just sort of a dead end. But even in heaven, you get reborn eventually somewhere else. In their story about the turning of the wheel from heaven to the animal realm, or back to the human realm, or back down to the hell realm, or something. We just keep shifting and changing as we go. Julian?
In truth, I understand the dynamic of being attached to sameness.
Mm-hmm.
at the same time, I've gotten the impression that people wanting to change something, but it's not necessarily not necessarily changing, or I guess it comes down to unable to accept whatever a situation or an object as it is,
yeah.
like a computer, for example, like
yeah.
insisting that, you know, the number one should function as the enter button would be a crude example, you know, like, and people getting frustrated with that as well.
Wanting it to be something else?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's the same as relying on something to be the same.
Well, you're describing our creativity when we begin to grumble about the way things are. And often it drives us to invent another way. And that's one way that we as a culture and as we live together keep sometimes improving. I'm not sure our changes are always improvements, but our creativity kicks in over and over again as we get irritated by things as they are. So it's not the worst thing in the world. But if we're understanding the world and understanding how our mind works, then that's a whole nother level. So at the very end here, Coben is talking about the subjective and the objective position, he calls it, of knowing. From our side, it's prajna, it's wisdom. But when we start identifying and discriminating things, dharmas, then that's vijna. The mind of cutting. V means to cut. So this whole seamless life that we're experiencing that's pouring through us all the time, the sounds and the smells and the feelings and all of it, we begin to say, apples, persimmons. And we say, you know, there's you and here's me. And that's all from the objective side. So we're taking our world that are constantly processing and creating, like Adam in the Bible, creating names for it and functions and relationships with it. So instead of like a baby just letting everything come and go in us, we begin to dance with the world. Discrimination, he says, is another word for vijna, the cut mind. And to not know is to not discriminate, but it's not ignorance. To not know is to accept the whole thing, to not ignore it. You cannot know in the ordinary sense of knowing, but you essentially know. Some Korean Buddhists, Zen Buddhists, base their whole teaching on not knowing. Don't know mind, they call it. And when you sit, you cultivate not knowing. Which isn't too different from what Dogen was teaching. You know, talks about think not thinking by non-thinking. But if, as you're sitting, you begin to think not thinking, you begin to have a feeling of what he's aiming at. This is all based on Zazen, of course. This is all the experience of sitting that this is coming from. Anything else? Like this example that Mel gives about an ant crawling on a book, but the ant has no idea it's a book. And somewhere somebody said, you think you have a pencil, and you say, obviously this is a pencil, but a dog would come along and chew on it and think it was a toy, you know? And if you needed a fire, you could use it to make a fire. And then it would just be firewood. So anything that we define with our Vijna mind can instantly transform into something else without even doing anything. It's our mind that transforms. That's how powerful our mind is. So there's an old koan in which a master gets up in front of his students and he says, what is it? What does he say? What is everyone's radiant light? And nobody can answer. They don't know what to say. And he said, it's the Dharma hall. It's the Buddha hall, it's the kitchen, it's the gate. It's the rocks and the trees and the stars. It's the cars going by outside. And it's each one of us. That's what the Heart Sutra is about. How to remember to be what we be. And enjoy it. So next week, we get to the part where the wheel of, what do they call it? Dependent co-arising, where birth all the way through around to old age and death. We say that in the sutra. That's Buddha's second turning of the wheel was his teaching of this wheel of life and death. And there are many, many pictures. I'll bring some next week of this wheel with little figures going through life from being born all the way to being dead. And it's all held in the claws of a monster, which is time. And inside are a pig and a snake and a rooster for greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's a very vivid metaphorical picture of what it's like to be a stuck human being. And the story is that only humans cannot get off of this wheel. If you're an animal or a hungry ghost or a heavenly being, you're stuck. still going around and around, that there's some extra thing that has to happen for a human being to be able to step off that wheel. So it's a very interesting concept. It was Buddha's insight that he made into a picture so that people could begin to feel it rather than just think about it. So I'll let you take that imaginary picture home, and then I'll bring some of the famous pictures of it that it's pretty scary, actually, when you think about it. It's also wonderful. So everyone in Arcata sends their very best to you all, and hope to come to the Jikoji Sesshin in February, which I hope we can come to. There was a lot of enthusiasm. There were new people who had never sat a Sesshin, or even sat. There was one woman who had sat one time with a Vipassana group for, you know, an hour or so. And she was invited, and she just on the spur of the moment said, well, okay. And she sat the whole 6 days. So, and there were young people from the university have started to come. And there were a lot of people who stayed the whole time. You know, so it was a core group that kept the whole thing going in a wonderful way. Nobody said a word. It was really quiet. And people came to the Ascendo before the bell rang. There was no rush at the door. It was incredible. I just felt like it was a miracle in a way. And it was so nice because of that. It created this wonderful atmosphere of ease. Everyone felt completely comfortable. At the last day, I ordained Jane Jasper. So she is now, I was going to say a monk, but she's a priest. She's been working on that for years and years and years, and she finally... I kept saying, wait, don't be in such a hurry. But finally, it just seemed like she had done enough work to achieve that, or step down into that is really what it is. It's making things even harder. But she was very, very happy about it. And the Arcata people were happy just to be a part of all of that, too. So that's my report. And as I say, I'm really glad to be back. This feels so good.